This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
If you're loving this podcast, we invite you to go deeper and partner with us in our work by joining the Gravity Commons, our online community of practice for connecting and learning together.
As a member of the Gravity Commons, you get access to live podcast recordings with upcoming guests, as well as other opportunities to connect and learn together with us in real time.
Including learning labs, member meetups, discussion boards, online courses, and our practitioner podcasts. Go to gravityleadership.com/commons to find out more. See you in the commons.
Ben, you grew up in a family, didn't you?
Yep, I had a full-on family. Yep.
Yeah. Did your family? Now you grew up in southern Minnesota,
southern Minnesota. Yeah, little town.
10,000 people. Minnesota. Okay. Mm-hmm. Did your family have little habits? Mm-hmm. Or practices that were unique to your family and you didn't know they were until you launched out into the big, brave blue world? Let me give you an example from my family. So back when I was a kid, back in the olden days, back in the 20th century.
And you had a family too? You grew up in a family?
I had a family as well. We have this in common. And they used to attach the phone to the wall. And it had a cord on the end of the phone, so you couldn't go anywhere. And when the phone would ring, we would answer it, and we didn't just say hello.
Okay.
We would say hello, Tebby residence.
Okay.
And that's how we were tutored to answer the phone. And if we didn't say hello, Tebby residence, we got in big trouble. And I remember the first time I went to a friend's house, and they were just like, "Hello." I was like, "What are you doing?
That person must think you're so rude now."
I'm just like, how will they know who they're calling?
Because people do just dial random numbers, and they're like, "I wonder whose number this is." Oh, it's the Tebby residence.
Another little cultural habit my family had is that we had little liturgies for when we sneezed and burped.
Okay.
So we had to acknowledge that what we did was maybe rude.
A faux pas.
Right. And so when we sneezed, we would say, "Excuse me."
Okay.
And you had to follow your sneeze up with "excuse me." And when you burped, you had to say, "Pardon me." But you couldn't say, "Pardon me for sneezing," or "Excuse me for burping."
Like, did you ever try, or was it just never done?
You would not train. This was an unspoken, unwritten rule that could not be transgressed.
Yeah, it was just how it is.
It's just how you do it.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time, again, I would, go outdoors sometimes.
Out into the world.
And go over to a friend's house, and people would burp and sneeze without indicating the immense burden it placed upon me to be in their presence. I was just like, these are heathens, these are barbarians.
You are excused.
Anyway, those are like two cultural liturgies in my family that were super, super strict, but that other people just didn't follow. So I'm wondering if you had things like that in the Sternke household.
You know, the only thing, there's probably other things, but the only thing that comes to mind right now is one of our liturgies was dinner at 6 on the dot. And that, like, it was, as somebody who now prepares food for my family most nights, I'm just exceedingly impressed by my mother's ability to have dinner ready at 6 p.m. on the dot every single night.
Yeah, you know, but you prepare like gourmet soups and etouffees. And your mom was just doing like probably Chef Boyardee cuisine, right?
I mean, she was a decent cook, but she had, you know, she had her like 2 week rotation. It was very.
This is nothing against your mom. This is nothing against your mom. No. But in the '80s, it was like, hey, homemakers,
hamburger helper.
Here is how to have an instant meal in a box full of sodium, and carbs. You know,
it means your kids are gonna love it. Yeah. But that was, it was, I recognized that not only was it not normal for families to have dinner together, like every single night, it was a liturgy, but I was just impressed with the specificity of 6 p.m. Yeah. And my dad was a doctor, and he would get home like literally 30 seconds before we started dinner sometimes. Like he would time his getting home to like my mom timing the dinner, and like we would all sit down at 6 p.m. and my dad would like pull in the driveway and then enter the door, put his bag down, and sit down at the table. That's how like coordinated this all was.
Yeah, this reminds
and
me
it was
of that,
just all normal.
Yeah, this reminds me of that old sea captain from Mary Poppins who would fire the cannon on top of his house, you know, on the dot.
I don't know if
it sounds like it just reminds me of like a military family, you know?
Yeah. It was so precise. I mean, nothing else about our family was military, was very strict or anything like that I can remember. It was just like that was when we ate, and it was like, boom, it was right on the dot, 6 p.m. So
fascinating, man.
Yeah.
Well, those were different times. Now people burp and sneeze, even fart with impunity.
Yep. And, you know, who knows when we're going to sit down for dinner. It'll be sometime after 5:30 and sometime before 8, typically at my house. So well, there's no meetings happening.
World's going anyway. To hell in a handbasket. But you know what you can count on? You know what you can count on is the Gravity Leadership Podcast to deliver the goods. And we're going to get into a great conversation today with Eric Seibert on enjoying the Old Testament.
Nope. KJ Ramsey.
What? Start it over. Cut it.
Start it over.
Just
so preview of coming attractions.
Aaron Sternke, go ahead and cut that out. I appreciate all the work you do, Aaron, on the cheap for us. Sorry. Well, I'm excited about Eric Seibert's interview. So look for
that's
that
coming
one soon.
In several weeks. Yeah.
But KJ Ramsey was also a delight, and this interview. I have to recalculate my inner feelings about this. Mm-hmm. Please hold.
He's recalling now. I can see it in his face.
I really like this interview with KJ.
It was so good, wasn't it?
Yep. I just got a subtle but pervasive wash of serotonin through my body because I was remembering how delightful this was.
It was.
And so, it's, there's your some interviews, Ben, if I may say, where it's kind of like a back and forth, and we get some information. And then there's some interviews where I feel like there's a real like joining that's happening.
Yeah.
Like there's
like a resonance, like we're communing together over the internet waves.
And I felt like that with KJ. She's great. Her book's incredible.
She's marvelous. Marvelous author. Marvelous writer.
Well, sorry, KJ, for thinking you were Eric. You'd look nothing like him. Mm-hmm. And your book is actually nothing like his. No. So hopefully we can get past this and carry on.
Carry on.
Online friendship. But before we get into KJ's interview, I just want to mention that I am starting a Gravity Leadership Academy cohort in the next several weeks. I have 2 spots left. If you've been on the fence or thinking I should get into that, or maybe I just want to learn more about that, I know you hear ads every week about it, but please let us know. Mm-hmm. This could be your moment. Celine Dion is singing somewhere. Mm-hmm.
This could be your moment.
Somewhere.
If we had some like cool background music, we could put it on in the background and just try to inspire people.
Yep. Additionally, Christy Penley is also starting a cohort, and she has a couple spots left. And I know there is a preferential treatment of Christy.
There's sometimes
in the Gravity
people
community.
Are like, I want to be part of Christy's cohort.
Yep.
So anyway. So yeah, hit us up.
If that tickles your fancy,
maybe just email you. Is that the best way to look into it, Matt?
Western Union. I prefer you using Western Union.
But
telegrams.
Because of the issue of time, you know, that
it is time sensitive. Yeah, I guess email then. I'll check emails.
Okay.
For this, I will check your email. Yeah, matt@gravityleadership.com. And send me that too for Christy, and I'll get you connected to her.
Perfect.
All right.
All right. Well, let's get into this interview with KJ.
Giddy up. KJ Ramsey joins us once again on the Gravity Leadership Podcast. She is a trauma-informed, licensed professional counselor and writer whose work offers space to see every part of our souls and stories as sacred. She holds degrees from Covenant College and Denver Seminary and is the author of This Too Shall Last, which we talked about the last time she was here, and the new book we're talking about today, The Lord is My Courage, Stepping Through the Shadows of Fear Toward the Voice of Love. She and her husband, Ryan, along with their two exceptionally cuddly dogs, Merton and Riza, live in near Denver, Colorado. KJ, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to chat about this book. Psalm 23 is probably one of the most famous texts in the world, right? People who don't profess Jewish or Christian faith, I think, are familiar with this psalm. And in this book, you take this really well-known psalm and you go word by word, phrase by phrase, to reflect on the theological and maybe psychological and formational wisdom therein. Help us understand, where'd you get the idea for this? What was the genesis or catalyst for using Psalm 23 in this way?
Yeah, I did not plan on writing a book about Psalm 23. I planned on writing a book about practicing courage, and I realized that the place that I had most learned to walk with courage and try to have courage, to receive courage, was in leaving and healing from spiritual abuse and religious trauma. And so I became just totally captivated by the story of Jesus feeding the crowds. And in Mark, it says he had compassion on them, for they were like sheep without a shepherd.
Yeah.
And I just started to dwell with that compassion of this Lord who has compassion on those who are like sheep without a shepherd. And eventually that kind of meditation on Christ took me to the roots of what Jesus was actually enacting there in the feeding of the 5,000, was a deliberate enactment of Psalm 23. So it was by means of my own pain and being a shepherdless sheep and coming back to this good shepherd that took me to the beginning of the good shepherd story in scripture. And then my mind just was blown from there. But
yeah, I have to say it's a beautiful cover. It's one of the most engaging, like every time I see it online or somebody posts about it, like I'm just drawn to it. And so, I know that a book, you know, don't judge a book by its cover.
If I did judge this book by its cover,
I would say we do. Of course we do. Right. That's why so much effort goes into creating them. Right. It's not, book covers aren't just the text of the book anyway. Yeah. But if I was going to judge your book by its cover, I would say it seems to line up really well. So it's just gorgeous and beautiful.
Thank you. Artwork.
Yeah,
I'm really grateful for how it turned out and that I got to help, like, have a designer that could envision something of what's really inside, and that, like, this is a dark journey, but it's beautiful, and I'm still just delighted with how that turned out.
Yeah, it's really well done.
Yeah. I think a lot of people think that books are written because someone is interested in something and they do a lot of research on it. And then they deliver their data or their investigation, and they teach us everything that they know and they've cogitated on. The way you narrate this book, though, is something happened to you that you wouldn't choose or wish on other people, and you had to make sense of that and figure out how to process and metabolize and walk through that. And out of the thing you wouldn't have chosen, was birthed something that brings hope and light and goodness to the world. Is this how your writing happens, KJ? Are you simply trying to be a good human, and from that comes bread for us? Is that typically how this works for you?
What happens is I am met in the middle of my own dark valleys, and the experience of being met there by this divine presence is too astounding to not share about. Hmm. And also, I am a big nerd, and I just like, I do.
So that helps. Yeah.
I think the nerdy part is like being the making sense of these experiences is that I've found over and over again as I combine, as I bring into conversation neuroscience and scripture and theological reflection, that they're saying the same things about this person who meets us. Mm-hmm. And it, I find, can be motivating to have hope that there is a shepherd coming to seek us, that goodness and love really are hounding us and haunting us, because there are ways to almost open yourself up to that reality breaking into your life. It's partly being met, and it's partly making sense of how that happens. And that it's not just for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
KJ, you know, we have a similar language. You use the dark matter as an analogy for love in the book. And actually, I want to quote something. You say, quote, "While dark energy is expanding the universe, dark matter is holding it together. Invisible love is sustaining the universe every moment of every day." And we use a metaphor in Gravity that communicates that same idea. I'm curious if you could just expand on how you see the love and the dark matter energy related.
Yeah.
Speaking of geeking out, like, this is, we love to geek out on this stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thankfully this opened straight up to where you're at there.
It was meant to be.
Yeah, that's kind of funny.
That's how the dark matter works.
I think that I've always been so fascinated by the Colossians 1, like, Jesus holds all things together. Yeah. And what does that mean? And that, like, in this this world of disparate experiences and people, that, like, the longer that I live, the more that I realize the separation between me and you is actually not as great as I imagine. That, like, we breathe the same air, and we are, like, you know, even now, our nervous systems are affecting one another as we make eye contact and we hear each other's voices. And so while that is not exactly the same thing as dark matter versus dark energy, I think that there is a heart to the universe wherein we are all being upheld, and we are all more connected than we imagine. And I think that is part of what I witness when I think about things like the way love is sustaining the universe through the ways, like, our atoms are being upheld. Mm. So that's my thoughts on that for today. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I really resonate with that, KJ. Just that the way that sort of
some of these new discoveries in science can kind of almost just lead us into mysticism. It was like, you know, during the Enlightenment, it seemed to demystify the world. But it's like, as we've progressed, it's like, oh, never mind. Maybe we had some things right, you know, about the way that we thought about the world, you know, the spirits and the unseen realm and our connection. And it's lovely to kind of go back to the scriptures and see some of those resonances. And even like ancient, you know, writers, the church fathers and the mothers, this is all kind of in there as well, for them. And so,
I don't claim to understand it, but then again, I don't understand God either. So I just mostly like, I marvel at those things that like, there is something holding us together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's the posture of contemplation that seems like it pervades your book, you know, not the posture of, oh, this is interesting, I'm going to think about it so I can explain it or understand it, but more like, I'm going to behold this reality. I'm going to, seek to sort of dwell in it and ruminate upon it. And so I appreciate that about your writing in general. Speaking of nerding out, you make use of polyvagal theory in this book to describe the emotional and body brain or the nervous system, as you just said, you know, reality to spiritual formation and growth. Can you give us a primer on polyvagal theory? I'm sure most of us are unfamiliar with it.
Yeah, so polyvagal expert Deb Dana talks about polyvagal theory as the science of feeling safe enough to, she doesn't say it quite like this, but say yes to your life. Like, it's the science of how we can feel safe enough to risk showing up in our lives and being loved and loving. Wow. The vagus nerve is the longest cranial nerve in your body. And it is one of the main pathways by which your nervous system responds to the world around you and moves you into safety and connection. And so polyvagal theory is a way of respecting the body's innate wisdom, the way God made our bodies, to bring us back to love. And that when we implicitly, or your body is like, your nervous system, I talk about this in the book, it's like a stealth surveillance system. So your nervous system is always scanning around you, within you, between us, for how safe you are to be able to show up and whether this experience is going to kill you physically or psychologically. And so that's happening, like this surveillance is happening, whether you are aware of it or not, and your responses to the world and to God are actually emanating from how safe you feel, whether you are paying attention or not. Wow. And I love to share polyvagal theory with people because I think there is so much more room to find our safety in God and this world, and be able to connect when we honor our body's needs for safety and connection and belonging. And by working with the body, we can find our way there much, much, much faster and more sustainably than when we treat our bodies like the barrier to belief.
Yes. We come by this honestly in the Christian tradition, right? There's entire traditions that say, you know, the body's bad,
right? Yeah.
It's full of sin and corruption. And so what it means to get spiritual is to transcend the body. One of the things that your book does, KJ, is helps us recover scripture not only as a place of revelation about God, but a place of revelation about what it means to be human. Mm-hmm. And what I appreciate about your work is that it's integrative, meaning you demonstrate the deep anthropological, psychological, and sociological knowledge that Scripture has about what it means to be human. And part of that is the way that the body is included and healed in salvation. Mm. Can you speak a little bit? And I know you talk about trauma in your book. You started this podcast talking about this book sort of being birthed out of your own healing from trauma. Can you describe how healing from trauma is related to polyvagal theory, and then also how it's related to Psalm 23?
Yeah. I don't know why my brain's going here, but it is, so I'm going to follow it. There's one of the epigraphs in the second part of the book is from the theologian Serene Jones. And she says, "Why is it so powerful to say that God was on the cross in Jesus Christ? Just what is the power of the cross? It is not about valorizing trauma, which the church has too often done, but actually about exposing trauma." And I'm going to trust that my mind called that up because we tend to, in the church today, in the church in America today, we find ourselves often on either end of a long continuum of either only honoring our problems and our pain, or turning pain and the cross into this spectacle of great purpose, which I think is what she means by valorizing trauma, not the valorization of trauma that I think some people are claiming trauma-informed therapists like me are doing today. But turning all the pain in our life into some grand purpose, which makes God into a cruel tyrant.
Yes.
So to get to, I think I'll come to this answer by way of Jesus and Jesus as the manifestation of the metaphor in Psalm 23. And that in Psalm 23, David is giving us this song and this story of a shepherd who seeks the lost sheep and provides even soothing. Like, he makes me lie down, he refreshes my soul. These are not about punishment, but actually like an image of regulation, of the shepherd. And he refreshes my soul. The shepherd actually coming to the sheep who is at its last breath. And like the theologian Robert Alter, the scholar, says, like breathing into the sheep to bring their breath back. And that, if you place that alongside polyvagal theory, is like the psalm actually is giving this grand picture of what the body actually needs to come back to that state of connection and calm. So let me come back to Jesus. Jesus, by becoming human and living a full human life and experiencing fear to the greatest magnitude, that his sweat was like drops of blood, dying before being raised, we find this God who is our shepherd comes all the way into the greatest and darkest depths of death that our bodies experience, to be able to bring us back to life. Mm. Like, it's that shepherd coming to the sheep and breathing into the sheep, that almost like creational image, and taken even further, this is God with us. And polyvagal theory shows us. For example, when you are in what we call a dorsal vagal state, this is, and we call this thing the autonomic ladder. So if you picture a ladder, yeah, you've got the top of the ladder, you got rungs coming down to the bottom. On a ladder, if you look at it, if you want to get to the top of a ladder, you can't jump there. Like, the rungs are the whole point. You have to climb all the way to the top. Your nervous system works just like that ladder. When you are at the bottom in a stress state of what we call dorsal vagal, you're feeling despair and you're feeling disconnected. You're in the Psalm 88 place of prayer of like, darkness is my only freaking companion. For your body to come back to the top where you can say, God is my rock and my rescue, my protector, you actually have to experience what we call co-regulation. And that's the physical presence of another person coming toward you. And the sound of their voice, the melody of this gentle voice, the hand on your shoulder, or the physicality of having someone sit with you. That's what polyvagal theory shows us we need to start rising from the bottom of the depths of our despair back up to our place of trust in God. And that is what Jesus Christ has given us in coming to this world and coming all the way down to the bottom so that we can all rise. So yeah, that's the healing of trauma, is his willingness to come and experience it himself so that he can be our great high priest who comforts us in all of our weaknesses, because he's experienced them.
This episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast is brought to you by Sacred Wilderness, a nonprofit that's driven by a single goal: to help people heal from church abuse. Sacred Wilderness was started by a team of individuals that have witnessed and experienced the harmful impact of spiritual abuse, and they connect spiritual abuse survivors to a healthy, supportive community and cover the costs for healthy spiritual triage, care, and therapy. If you need resources to help facilitate your healing from spiritual abuse, to learn more or to help support this work, you can visit sacredwilderness.org. That's sacredwilderness.org. Thanks for supporting this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
What is so profound, KJ, in this book and even in our conversation, is how your work of tethering theological and psychological truths together reclaims the body as the place of salvation. Mm. And we desperately need this. We see all kinds of evidences that much of the white Western theological tradition has tended to abstract spiritual things, dematerialize what's spiritual, right? Mm. We come by this honestly, right? We talk about ledgers and accounts having been reckoned, and we talk about things like that. But what we don't talk about is our bodies as a temple of the Holy Spirit, and how God wants to heal not just maybe a toxic neurotic conscience, but wants to heal our nervous systems. even as I say that, I don't know, KJ, because this is your discipline, this is where you operate in God's authority and power, that might not seem scandalous to say to you, but as I say these words, I'm like, is it okay if I say this? This shouldn't be, right? Am I going to get in trouble for this? What's your relationship like to that? Is this something that you have a similar kind of reaction that I do, or do you have a different perspective on that?
Yeah, it's not scandalous to me anymore, but the comments on my work, like on Instagram, tell me that it definitely is scandalous to some people. No, it's not scandalous to me anymore, but because it's still stunning. It's stunning to me. I just have such great need of it. I have such great need of this savior and this shepherd that meets me and that meets my clients. And so like, yeah, I'm a complex trauma survivor. You know, in this book, I talk about my experience in church, but I also have profound childhood trauma. And that gets real complex to write about. So there's lots of stories that are untold, but I still have in my nervous system so much that pushes me towards self-protection and shutdown and shame, because I spent so many years of my life having to protect myself from deep, deep harm. And so that story still lives in my body. And the story of Jesus is also living in my body because Christ dwells in me by the Spirit. And so as I, you know, even before this, I was moving slow. Last night we had like got together with some other survivors of religious trauma. And so we had a late night. We ended up talking way too late. And this morning was like, I was moving much slower than I wanted. And so I was running a little bit late. And so I felt a little on edge, just like my nervous system. I could tell I was in a little bit of a stress state before coming to talk to you guys. So instead of coming on time, I spent 2 minutes like giving my body what she needs so that I could not relate to all of you out of a state of scarcity or stress, but like be grounded. And so, you know, I did what we call havening, which is a technique for nervous system regulation that was studied at Harvard. And I'm like telling myself the truth. I am safe. Mm-hmm. I'm secure. I can show up.
And you're rubbing your hands together. Is that,
yeah.
Is that part of it? Yeah.
Yeah. This yeah.
So
is
just for
hands,
our listeners,
face.
Yeah,
they
she's
can't.
Rubbing her hands together. She's kind of rubbing
yeah,
her own
it's
shoulders.
A very
yeah.
easy way to like include the body in yeah. being soothed because yeah. your body has like your skin has nerve receptors that connect mm-hmm. with the parts of your brain that help you remember and tell your body, mm-hmm. I'm safe. It's okay to connect. It's okay yeah. to slow down. And it worked. So yeah. I am not scandalized by it because I'm just like, I need it. And this is where God meets me. And it's the evidence in my own life is when yeah. I let God meet me in this way in my physical body, I get to show up in ways that yeah. my story would generally bar me from.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There's a couple things I just want to highlight about that, KJ. I think first thing is a little joke. We were joking that, you know, you apologized when you first got on for being 2 minutes late. And I just remarked that I'm often 2 minutes late to things, but my reason is not that I'm havening usually. I was telling everybody else that my you reason are, that I'm trying to jam another email in before my next appointment.
KJ's havening. So, you are hastening.
Hastening, yeah. I'm trying to get another thing done, checked off the list.
That's funny.
Anyway, so I was trying to get a little free therapy from KJ too before we hit record about that. Why is that? Why am I like this? Sorry. What was the other thing I wanted to say? Oh, I just
you're gonna ask KJ for Venmo so you could pay her for that.
right. I'm sorry. No. I'm sorry for asking you for free therapy. Here's $10 for my 2 minutes of therapy.
You're good.
No, I loved your answer. You know, like, you know, Matt asked, like, oh, is this okay to say? And you know, you admitted there is some controversy out there about whether it's okay for you to say the things that you're saying. But I loved your answer that, like, well, I have to say these things because I need to. Like, I need them. I need these realities, and they've actually borne fruit in my life. And so I just love that posture, you know, and it's such a contrast from the posture of, no, I'm right, and here's why. Here's 18 reasons why. But just the humility of being able to say, well, you know, it's actually maybe, I don't know, irrelevant if I'm right or not, but this is helpful for me. And this has borne good fruit in my life. And so I have to say this.
Well, and I wish it was more implemented within church culture, church talk, because it's just not. I recently went to within the last 6 months to a retreat. It was like a 4-day retreat. It was not a Christian faith-based retreat. And it was really focused on the vagus nerve. Mm-hmm. And I went and had all these experiences and learning how to ground yourself, breath work. Mm-hmm. We did ice baths. Stick work. There's all this stuff. And I came back and I was like really scared to tell anybody what just happened. Mm-hmm. And yet there was this sense of freedom that I had not experienced. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm meeting with a counselor and doing all this trauma work. And I went into that first meeting with her after the retreat. And I'm like, I feel scared to tell you. And I was like, I need a place to communicate about this. And where does it? Because I had learned all of this outside of a faith kind of based thing. And so I was, you know, breath work, I just naturally connected to prayer. And now these things are, even a cold shower, like there's all these different practices that people do for the vagus nerve. And implementing those within my daily life, but also connecting them to spiritual disciplines and practices has been life changing for me. Mm-hmm. And I'm still learning, I'm still growing, I'm still discovering, but was so excited to have this interview because I was like, ooh, this is a place where like we all get each other. And like when I say things like this, you guys are all shaking your head. Yes.
Yeah.
And,
Chrissy's like, I can talk about trauma camp here.
I can't. That's what I called it. I called it trauma camp to them. Oh my gosh. But maybe you can speak a little bit to kind of the breath work and prayer and the connection and how you practice that. I would love to hear you kind of double click on that if you could.
Yeah. Oh gosh. I loved everything you just said. So first of all, yes. So good. You know, yesterday in this hanging out with these fellow survivors in their backyard, one of the guys has a tattoo that's a piece of art from Scott Erickson that's got lungs and Yahweh on it. And I think that's a great visual of breath and prayer. You know, the Hebrew for spirit is ruach, and there's this deep, inherent beauty and truth that the spirit of God is the breath of God. And even in Psalm 23, like we've talked about a little bit, that image of he refreshes my soul is this shepherd getting down on the ground with this sheep that, because the sheep has been so terrified by a predator, is not breathing. And the shepherd breathes life back into the sheep, which is, you know, an allusion to the creation story of the way that God kneeled to the dirt of this earth and breathed us into being. Mm-hmm. So our relationship as humans, but as Christians to breath is a hearkening back to the beginning. And there is so much room to remember our breath, to remember our inherent connection to God that's constant. So for me, the way that started was years ago, in starting to play with this and starting to, in my work as a therapist, but also in my own recovery from trauma, I was realizing how stressed I was all the time and that I didn't want to live my life like that because when I'm stressed, I am irritable and easily overwhelmed and go to dark places. And one of the first places that I started to find comfort and to seek that comfort out and to practice that I am okay because God is with me was breath prayer. And it was just at first I wanted to have like my own prayer that I would pray of like on my inhale and on my exhale because I'm an Enneagram 4 and I wanted to be all special. And then I realized like, I don't need to think of something different. Like the Jesus prayer has been prayed by Christians for millennia, and I can just come back to that. So I started practicing a shortened version of the Jesus prayer. It's just on my inhale, Lord, exhale, have mercy. And, you know, it's, I don't need to get into the longer version of it, but finding, coming to my breath and practicing just that inhale and a slightly longer exhale throughout my days really brought more peace into my life because I was not physiologically as stressed. As we lengthen our exhale, we're actually signaling throughout our nervous system that we can be safe because when we're in a stressed state, our exhale, basically our whole breath becomes shorter and more rapid, more shallow. So a longer exhale often will communicate safety. And you can give your body that cue of, we're okay. And with trauma, what happens is that like we interpret the present based on our horrible past and it's happening implicitly. And maybe like you're actually more safe in this moment than it feels like you are. And right. Breath is one of those small things that can signal to your body, it's okay to be here right now.
Yeah.
So I now practice with breath. I mean, I continue to practice breath prayer. It's a constant in my life. I carry like a holding cross often, and I come back to this often when I'm with clients just as a like a physical, tangible reminder to breathe.
Yeah.
I also, it's just like any moment where I'm always paying attention to what's happening here and just like, am I starting to rush? Am I tuning out? And my breath is my way, like my vehicle back to presence. Yeah. But it's extended beyond simple breath prayer. One of the big things that I practice now also is the emotional freedom technique, tapping. Mm-hmm. And that, or havening is another thing too, but that with things like tapping, which we don't need to explain all of what it is. And there's a little bit about that in my book, but it's a way to just another way to work with my body and with my breath to signal safety. And even when I'm doing something like a tapping meditation, for me, it is remembering my communion with God is here and secure no matter what's happening. And it's just, it's remembering my story. It's remembering my place. And my body is helping me find my way back to that being most true, that yeah. God really is with me. And it's just remarkable what happens within me when I am really, really stressed out and I really don't want to do something like tapping or take 30 seconds to just breathe. Because you generally, like, it's the same Romans 7, like, I do what I don't want to do, and I don't do what I should, and it, like, it's the same thing with regulation.
Yeah, it's true,
but,
isn't it?
But when I choose the good, and I turn toward the God who is with me, my body sure helps me find my way there, and I can, within a 10-minute tapping session, move from deep distress to even delight.
Yeah.
By the end. And that is because of my body that God made. So those are some thoughts on breath.
That's so good, KJ. I feel like we could talk to you for a long time about this, and we may hit you up later to talk about some of this stuff.
I'm going to invite you to coffee. I'm only an hour away.
I know. Dang it.
Next time I'm up at Denver Seminary, I'm like, hey.
So. But, you know, we have a practice in our training that is just the practice of proclaiming good news, declaring good news to one another and to ourselves, you know, and the truth about who God is. But I think you're sort of filling in some gaps here for me in terms of, I think the way that we normally think about that, we just generally, is as some sort of message. It's a cognitive, like, message. It's a verbal truth that is like, that I'm supposed to apprehend and sort of stuff into my brain until I believe it. But I love what you're talking about with
I love what you're talking about with the, you know, the tapping and the havening and all these breathing. All these techniques are basically ways, embodied nonverbal ways of proclaiming good news to yourself, and leading, you know, others in the proclamation of good news, because all of those messages that you're sending to your body are messages of good news. They're the messages of the gospel, that you're safe, that God is with you, that it's okay to be here now, that you can be vulnerable, you can open up. It's just beautiful. So anyway, I think we have some integration work to do before we do any more writing on what it means to declare good news. I appreciate it.
I just want to say to that, it's not what I am trying to offer people. And it's, you know, and it's not just me. I'm just part of a huge tradition of people that are bringing these things out there. But I'm not rejecting the good news or circumventing it. I'm just trying to help us receive it in a way that our bodies actually can receive it.
Yes.
That's right.
And the truth is that when we are stressed, when we feel shame, when we are overwhelmed, when we are mired by trauma, our bodies cannot actually take in much verbally.
Yeah.
Like when you're in a state of stress, your body isn't communicating with the Broca's area in your brain, which is the area responsible for language.
Yeah.
So you can't take in some scripture that you've memorized,
right?
Because your body isn't making those neural connections while you're that stressed.
Right.
And so to tell yourself the good news by means of your body actually starts with where you are, which is really an expression of the incarnation.
Yeah.
And it actually brings your body back to a place of being able to form words and receive words and share words. But it's the word became flesh and dwelt among us. I think for us to receive that in the middle of our hard moments and hard seasons, we come back to our flesh and dwell with it.
Yeah. That's well said. Beautiful.
Yeah. This is all kind of brand new to the Western world. Like, we're waking up to how bodies work and how trauma works. But it's not brand new throughout history. And it's the scriptures don't have to teach on it because people just knew this stuff. It's like, it's assumed. And the things your book does, KJ, is it draws out what's assumed and helps integrate with what's assumed in the scriptures to what we're just learning today and places it all as an offering before the Lord. And so, I think I told you on social media, or I told the world on social media that I was trying to read this book quickly and I couldn't. So thanks a lot for that, KJ. Thanks for writing such a good book. I couldn't read it quickly. But it's worth a delicate, decisive, deliberate read, and heartily recommend it. So thank you for this book. Thank you for the way that I feel mothered by you and I mean that like in a, you know, it's a metaphor. I feel like a mother, like you're helping parent me into a more holistic integration of these disciplines that often hang out in disjointed ways in my life. So I really appreciate that. KJ, how can people connect with you or find you if they want to do so?
Sorry, I'm having a moment just receiving that. That was so kind. People can find me and my work at kjramsey.com. There's links to everything there. And I'm on social media at KJ Ramsey Writes. I'm mostly on Instagram. And then I just occasionally say things on Twitter and Facebook, but mostly on Instagram.
And then get out quick. Quick, say
and
things.
And then get out quick. I don't really interact very much on Twitter. But yeah, that's where people can find me in my book.
Yeah. Awesome. And I'll just say one other thing too that's kind of frustrating about your book, KJ. Every chapter, and there's like, I don't know, 30 chapters. Every chapter, 35. Okay, every chapter, there are at least two books you quote from that I'm like, my Amazon cart is busting at the seams.
Good. So that's the point.
Yeah, it was super great. Anyway, the book is called The Lord Is My Courage, Stepping Through the Shadows of Fear Toward the Voice of Love. KJ, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, we'd love it if you tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode.
You can join our Gravity community for free. You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as an email most Fridays with curated links to articles that we found interesting or helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our show is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his work at aaronsturkey.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.